Welcome to the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast. Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast. With me today is Andrew Toot, Chief Investment Officer of Forefront Ventures. Thank you very much for joining me today, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right, before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also do us a big favor by leaving a positive review on whatever platform you use. And if you want to reach the podcast, you can reach me at david@cannabisequipmentnews.com. All right, Andrew, I wanted to get started and just learn a little bit about yourself. You know, how did you find yourself in the cannabis industry?
That's a good question. So I started my career in finance. I was a very junior investment banker right out of school. And quickly after that, jumped over to the buy side where I was a small cap growth analyst and portfolio manager here in Boston. I worked most of my career at BlackRock here in Boston. And one of my oldest friends in the business had left Wall Street to go work for the family office of a man named John Sperlin, who started University of Phoenix. And Josh Rosen, who was the founder of Forefront, started it within Sperlin's family office. So Forefront started as a consultancy where we would win licenses on behalf of clients and then help get up and running. And so Josh Rosen asked me to invest soon after I left BlackRock in 2013. And, you know, I was looking for something else to do with my career and, you know, never really considered, you know, cannabis as a viable career path. But after about a year of convincing and showing Forefront's need for additional talent in our company and into the industry, I was convinced to come in full time. And I've served as a capacity of raising money for Forefront and doing a lot of the investor relations, and also have been on the strategic side as well. So it's been a long journey. I've been in close to 7 years at this point.
So in those 7 years, have you determined whether or not cannabis is a viable industry?
Cannabis is a very much a viable industry. There are a couple different paths where, you know, I could have taken the off ramp if, you know, it didn't look like legalization was ever going to be in the cards. Where, you know, I could have gone back to a more traditional career. But it's been a fascinating ride from 2013 through now. It's been incredible to watch the industry bloom. Excuse the pun. But it, you know, this went from an industry where, you know, you kind of had you know, a bunch of people scrounging around for licenses and seeing if they could get grows open, to one where, you know, you have multi-billion-dollar market caps that trade on public markets. So I think that we're in the probably second or third inning of what is going to be an incredible run for cannabis here over the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, I believe.
Tell me a little bit about your work specifically with Forefront Ventures. Could you tell me a little bit about your role with the company?
Yeah, so I started in a role that was really around money raising. And making sure that the company was properly capitalized and sort of leveraging, you know, my former career in finance to raise money and to find sources of capital. And I also spent a lot of time early on being the gray hair in the room when we were applying for licenses. So we had a strategy, you know, we shifted from being a mere consultant in 2015 under the premise of, well, geez, we're really good at winning these licenses on behalf of clients, and we have an operations team that's opened these across the country. Why aren't we just doing this on our own behalf? And so we switched the focus of the business to, you know, leveraging our expertise, winning licenses, to go and get licenses in every state we could. And typically those, you know, when you apply for these licenses, you have to go in and show that you're a responsible professional. And, you know, if you're going to do business in whatever municipality you're applying to do business in, they want to know you and they want to understand what you're all about. So in the early days, outside of money raising, I was spending a lot of time meeting with politicians and just getting them comfortable with not only cannabis, but with me as a person and our company, getting them comfortable as an operator in their municipality. So that was originally what I did. And, you know, the role kind of evolved. I was a CFO for a short time early on in 4Front's history. And I'm actually interim CFO right now. We're in between CFOs. But spend a lot of time on the strategic side of things now too. In addition to, you know, the investor relations and the capital raising, it's really important for us to, you know, make sure that we have the right strategy and make sure that we're executing on that strategy. And while a big portion of our course is organic, we're also really focused on adding to our portfolio through bolt-on acquisitions. So I've been pretty instrumental in on the M&A side too for our company.
Were the challenges that you had raising capital at the beginning, are those some of the same challenges you're having now, or has it evolved?
It is absolutely, well, it's night and day, but let me give you a couple caveats. You know, I think that there were a handful of players that had access to capital. Ben Kovler, GTI, had you know, not only family money, but was pretty well plugged in the family office community. So he had an easier time raising money. And Boris over at Curaleaf was leveraging some of his connections, and he's always been well capitalized. But by and large, you know, the rest of us have been, you know, out there scraping and fighting for money for a long time. And so in the early days, it was, you know, passing the hat in my friend group. Mm-hmm. And then sort of graduated to raising a little bit of money up in Canada. And I would say now there is, you know, coming from an environment where you're really scrapping and clawing for capital every step of the way, companies that have proven operating capabilities are now able to attract capital at actually increasingly reasonable rates. The cost of capital is coming down for the industry, especially those companies that have proven that they can execute and operate. So there is all the debt financing you want is out there right now. The equity markets aren't really open right now for cannabis, but I expect that they will be if we can get banking passed. But you know, there's financing available for those of us that have proven operations.
As the company evolved from a consultancy to a multi-state operator, you know, what were some of the hiccups along the way? I mean, it's one thing to kind of sit at the table and say, "Hey, we're doing." give me the abridged version. You know, it's because I've been in rooms like that before where everyone's telling themselves, well, we're already doing it for everybody else. Why don't we just do it for ourselves? But then, you know, actually making that happen is quite a journey.
It's a great comment. So we were, you know, we started as a consultant and we had operations teams on the retail side that were really good at setting up retail stores. And you know, we got these licenses and, you know, we knew what we were doing. But, you know, there were a couple things we knew we were doing on the retail side. We were not so good on the cultivation and production side. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that made this even more difficult is that, as you know, in cannabis, you can't take product over state lines that has THC in it. Mm-hmm. And so you have to replicate. You have to have, you know, both the talent and the capital to replicate your operations in each state that you want to license. And I would submit to you that, you know, scaling, you know, a taco chain would across multiple geographies would be very, very difficult. But, you know, sort of add a degree of difficulty just with a heavily regulated cannabis industry. You know, everything about standing up these operations, you know, is, you know, comes with an inordinate amount of red tape, whether you're setting up a banking account, whether you're, you know, trying to convince a landlord that, you know, cannabis is okay to go on or to be grown in his facility. So it's just, there's just red, and then convincing the municipality that, you know, you're an upstanding citizen and that you will be a good member of the community in which you operate. So I think one of the, so back to the original, you know, what were the biggest problems? I think that, you know, we sort of were kids in the candy store early on. We were really good at winning these licenses. And so we'd throw our hat in the ring for every de novo license, licensing, every licensing process that came up in de novo states. And, you know, we were spread too thin. And so one of the things that we did about 3 years ago was we merged with a company called Canex, who had operations in Washington State. And Canex was the number two edible, or is the number two edible manufacturer, and the other facilities are the number two edible manufacturer in Washington, number one edibles producer, number two flower producer in Washington State, and one of the most competitive markets in the country. Mm-hmm. And they have figured out a couple things in Washington. But most importantly, it's how to wring cost out of the manufacturing side of this business. Mm-hmm. And that is a really important point and really important to our business model, because there is a lot of elasticity in the end markets for cannabis, meaning that if you can give a consumer a very good product at a great price, you're going to take outsized market share. And the way that you can offer the consumer a great price is by automating. And so if you walk into our facilities in Washington State right now, it looks like the Mars Candy Company. It doesn't look like, you know, a mom and pop kitchen where people are making edibles in the back and filling up vape cartridges with a pipette. Fully automated, wringing the cost out of this process, where we make 25 different brands, over 1,000 different SKUs of product, from vape pens to infused pre-rolls to gummies to chocolates, et cetera. And so that low cost production, you know, and that expertise on the cultivation and finished goods manufacturing side was really complementary to our business. And so we came through last year where we streamlined our portfolio, we cut a lot of costs, and we have a very simple investment thesis. We are replicating these tried and true production methodologies that we've honed in Washington State and have afforded us great market share in Washington State. And we're porting them to Massachusetts, Illinois, California, Michigan. And we have a license pending in New Jersey that we hope to be winning soon. And so very, very straightforward business model, but it was a pretty roundabout way to get there.
What was that transition like, bringing successful operations from Washington into your other states?
It was, you know, the team, our operations team, led by Leo Gontmaker, our CEO, and Joe Feltham, who's our chief operating officer. They just did a phenomenal job making sure that, you know, things were done the Washington way outside of Washington. So we have the luxury of having a very deep bench. So we were able to take some of the folks who were on the ground in Washington and put them into our Massachusetts and Illinois facilities right off the bat. We were able to, you know, quickly streamline and make sure that we were using consistent growing methodologies in consistent environments across our company. And that's not only afforded us, you know, yields that we think are industry leading in terms of the grams per square foot we can get out of our cultivation facilities, but we've also introduced all of the Washington brands in Massachusetts right off the bat. And we are really pleased with how our thesis is playing out, of replicating those production methodologies and bringing those brands to other states. You know, the proof of concept is replicating that in one other, in another state, and proving that that works. And we're very, very pleased with, you know, how things have been going in Massachusetts and Illinois. And we're on the cusp of opening a, what we think is the biggest cannabis production facility in the world in Southern California. And we're hoping to get approval on that within the next few days.
What are you looking at in terms of grams per square foot?
In Massachusetts, in our Worcester facility, we've been as high as 500, which is, you know, I think the cost, the industry average is somewhere between 150 and 200. You know, it's, everyone calculates it a little bit different, but it's in that ballpark. And we've been able to, you know, that's sort of the high end, but I think across all our entire portfolio, we're kind of averaging somewhere between 350 and 400 grams a square foot.
I mean, is that all, how do you guys do that?
It's a lot of trial and error. You know, it's, you know, Carl Toscano, our president, you know, says it's a lot of skin knees. You know, in Washington, you saw when the recreational market turned on, you saw the price per pound of cannabis go from, you know, somewhere around $2,000 a pound all the way down to $600 a pound. And we, you know, necessity is the mother of all invention. And we sort of had to figure out, okay, well, geez, you know, if you're trying to sell weed at $600 a pound, how are you going to do that profitably? And so we have a pretty extensive R&D effort in Washington where we can, you know, test the different strains and play with the more robust, higher yielding strains. And we have sort of a pretty broad selection of those. But most importantly, you know, it's our growing methodologies and our environment that we grow in. One of the things that, you know, we've seen in Massachusetts and have seen really across the country is, you know, Colorado growers, you know, originally came out to Massachusetts and said, this is how you set up a grow. And by and large, when you look at East Coast grows, they are very underinvested in HVAC. And so people cut corners there, which is kind of a deadly mistake because, you know, you start to get mold in those facilities because there's too much moisture. You know, you can have a $6 million crop wiped out. So attention to how we are constructing these facilities, how the workflow works, you know, clearly strains are important, but HVAC is of the utmost importance. And, you know, we continue to refine. You know, we have two facilities in Washington. One is down by Olympia and one is west of there in Elma. So Olympia was version 1.0. Elma was version 2.0. We finished retrofitting both of our Massachusetts facilities, and those are sort of versions 3.0. And then we have a new facility going up in Illinois, which is going to take all the lessons that we've learned along the way and incorporate into a big grow facility there that we intend to open late next year, which will be about 65,000 square foot of cultivation and a 70,000 square foot production facility.
So I've covered mergers previously, and sometimes there's a lot of difficulty in terms of there being redundancies, or, you know, you're bringing in people that know what they're doing in Washington and trying to bring them across the board and other operations. Did you have any problems there, or people pretty welcoming of trying to figure out a better way of doing business?
I think that by and large, you know, growers in the cannabis industry can be sort of the prima donnas. You know, my way is the best way and I grow the best weed. And I think that, you know, before we, you know, do mergers with folks, we spend a lot of time doing diligence, making sure everyone's on the same page that, hey guys, we can all make each other better. There are some things that, you know, we do better. There's some things that you're going to bring to the table to make us collectively better. And so I think, you know, after after, you know, this, the merger closed with Canex, for instance, you know, we had some of those folks on the ground here in Massachusetts a week later, and those teams were working incredibly well together. And so we try to be collaborative as possible and have everyone pushing towards, you know, what's best for the company and producing the best results for the company.
Bringing, replicating what was in Washington, was there, you know, was it specific types of equipment? You talk about, you know, how automation really makes everything work. Is it any specific type of equipment or process, that's working best for you?
Yes. You know, we have, you know, a lot of equipment. We sort of view it as proprietary.
Okay.
But you know, if you look at, this is an example that I love to bring up. Mm-hmm. We're the number one edibles manufacturer in Washington state. And our gummy cube is called the Marma. Mm-hmm. And to make, we're the low cost producer in Washington. We can make 3,600 boxes of Marmas in one shift using 25 people. And that's a very automated facility. What we're doing in California is basically putting that automation that we've taken from Washington and putting it on steroids for California. Mm-hmm. So I said we made 3,600 boxes in one shift using 26 people. With the automation that we have in California right now, we're going to make 30,000 boxes one shift using 4 people.
Oh, wow.
So if you walk into this facility, it's consumer packaged goods. It's, mm-hmm. You know, the Mars Candy Company, it is high scale production, mm-hmm. That we've been able to, you know, just find the places in the supply chain where it makes sense to automate and where we can, you know, continue to sort of wring labor out.
As you wring labor out, you know, you're bringing in more automation. I have to imagine that, you know, as you're bringing that across, what, 5 other states, that has to be a substantial cost.
Yeah, this facility that we are building in we hope to get their certificate of occupancy next week. Mm-hmm. That's been a $40 million project for us.
Oh my goodness!
So pretty substantial in terms of, you know, the equipment that we brought in. We're not even growing there. That's just finished goods manufacturing. And then when your building grows, you know, we tend to, I wouldn't say overspend, but I'd say our the way that we build out grows, as I said earlier, we spend a lot of attention on HVAC and process. So, you know, you can spend $40-50 million building out a cultivation facility too. So it's a very capital intensive industry. Mm-hmm. But the returns on, you know, that capital, you know, are approaching triple digits with a lot of the projects that we're pursuing.
As you retrofit these old other facilities, what do you do with the old equipment?
A lot of the lights, we just recently switched to LED lights in Massachusetts and Illinois. I think we've mothballed those lights. I don't know if we've sold them on the secondary market or not. It's actually a great question. You know, and then on the HVAC side, I think that we resold that as well. So, it's a great question. I'm not positive where we've landed on some of that replacement equipment.
How long do you essentially test a new process before you decide to bring it sort of system wide, you know, just because it is such a big expenditure?
That's a great question. We usually about 6 months. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we will bring in, you know, new machinery to, you know, Washington, which is basically our test lab, where we can demo, tweak, make sure that we've got the kinks out, make sure that it's going to fit into our processes seamlessly. And so before we do, you know, anything system-wide, roll out anything system-wide, we're doing heavy R&D in the Washington facility.
How closely do you work with those OEMs or equipment manufacturers when you're trying to get new equipment in?
Incredibly closely. We've had engineers, you know, with the equipment that we just put into California, we have a full kitchen line, full tincture line, mint line, gel cap line, infused pre-roll line. All of that equipment, you know, had representation for the OEM on the ground with us in California. You know, as we fine-tuned our recipes, they were right with us while we were doing all that. So I would, on average, I think that, you know, crews from our OEMs, you know, are with us for anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks when we start a new machine.
So starting out in finance, and now it sounds like you're in a lot deeper with cultivation, manufacturing, and even at the dispensary level. When did you decide to make that switch?
You know, it's kind of a personal story that I'd like to share. Like do you mean in terms of make the switch from being more of a finance guy to being more of an operator?
Yes, but let's start. What's the personal story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I got out of finance, you know, I live in a little suburb outside of Boston, and you know, three little kids, and you know, towards the end of my, you know, run managing money, you know, I was sort of tired of, you know, chasing basis points and always chasing performance quarterly in the finance world. And I was really looking to do something different. And when this opportunity presented itself, I was sort of like, I don't know. I've got three little kids and, you know, I'm on the finance committee at church, and am I really going to get into the weed business? And this is 2013. And, you know, my wife, I sort of said, you know, Beth, do you want to go to garden club? Do you want to go and be married to the weed guy? And that was very a foreign concept to me, that you know, you just go from something so mainstream as finance and get into cannabis. And it was really my wife that I credit with, like, no, I think you should go for it. I think that, you know, you've been doing the same thing for 20 years of your career. The last couple, you've been less happy. Like, go and jump into something new. And I think this is be a great opportunity. I think you should go for it. And, you know, that permission, it was really unencumbered for me, and, you know, allowed me to sort of really put my mind and my shoulder into, you know, trying to make Forefront a success. And so it's, you know, this career has not been without its challenges, but I've learned a ton. You're always solving problems. And it's, you know, ultimately been a lot of fun.
It's amazing what that little extra push from your partner can do to help out, right?
Really, well, you know, it was one of those sort of eureka moments. And, you know, you always know that you love your wife, but you're like, thank you, honey. That was really good. Really appreciate that. You know, to recognize that, you know, I probably needed to, you know, get out of my comfort zone a little bit and go do something that was new and fun.
So going back to the operational perspective now, how did you kind of transition? Just because I read in your bio that, you know, you were doing more cultivation manufacturing. How'd you expand your role within Forefront?
Yeah, I mean, look, I know enough about production and cultivation to be dangerous. And, you know, as a manager, we have, you know, a really, really deep bench of in our operations teams. You know, we lean on pretty, you know, pretty heavily. So I think that I am more around in the operations just because we're an operating business and you have to know what the needs are of the operations in terms of, you know, what would fit strategically into our company and what we need and so forth. And so, you know, instead of just flying around talking to investors and meeting with politicians, you know, making that jump into really understanding, you know, what makes the operations tick has been a terrific jump for me, because as a portfolio manager, you know, you're always the armchair quarterback, right? So, you know, my time at BlackRock, you can call up a small cap company and you can say, you know, you knucklehead, you missed your quarter, and, you know, what's going on operationally? You said that this was going to happen. And so, you know, being on the other side of the table, you just get such a appreciation for execution, how important execution is in building a company and garnering investor confidence in you. So, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm a whole hog on the operations side. That would be an overstatement by quite a lot. But, you know, I've definitely, you know, come in from just finance to be, you know, more well-rounded executive in this company.
So, and let me know if I miss any, but you have operations in California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, and Washington, with New Jersey pending. Anything else on the horizon or states that you're trying to get into?
Well, we have said that, you know, we want to be a scaled producer in every state that we're in. And obviously we're going to have scale in California with this big facility opening up. In Washington, you know, we already have pretty significant market share out of our facilities. In Illinois, we have one of the 20 licenses that allows for 210,000 square feet of canopy, which is a massive facility. So we are building, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we currently have 9,000 square feet of canopy, and that's going to go up to 65,000 next year. So that's under construction. And then when you turn to Massachusetts, you know, we have about 15,000 square feet of canopy, and that basically serves our three stores, and we have desires to be a wholesaler. And so we are, you know, in the final throes of closing an acquisition here in Mass, which would greatly increase our production capabilities. So outside of those, outside of, you know, winning New Jersey, I think that, you know, we are always interested in talking to people that have scale in large and sort of nascent rec markets. So we're always looking. I will tell you that the M&A environment right now for cannabis could not be hotter. Everyone's talking to everyone. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, I think that there's going to be a wave over the next year where people are finding dance partners.
Yeah.
And so when we look at M&A, you know, we want to create value for shareholders, but we also want it to make us, we want that acquisition to make us a prettier girl, meaning more desirable, you know, potential acquisition target for, you know, something bigger. And, you know, we're big believers that, you know, with the knowledge and skill and the critical mass we have in the markets we're in, you know, we'd be, our shareholders could be well served as part of a, you know, as from being part of a larger platform as well.
How do you find a dance partner that makes you bigger, but isn't biting off more than you can chew?
It's a terrific question. I think that, you know, finding a dance partner, you know, you usually have, you know, two problems. You have, you know, you can sort of have a standoff with, you know, my guys are better. No, my guys are better. And, you know, who's going to run this thing, you know, going forward. You know, when, and you have those types of conversations. So that's sort of the biggest sort of hurdle to getting M&A that works. I think your point about not biting off more than can be true is a terrific one, because, you know, executing and operating these businesses is really, really hard. And, you know, when you look at where we were as a company last year, we were in, you know, we had four additional states that we were in that we eventually divested, you know, not only streamline our business, but to streamline our focus. Mm-hmm. And so when we're having conversations with bigger dance partners, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, everyone's operations are stable and you don't have to go in and fix a bunch of their stuff. Clearly there's some incremental stuff that we, for instance, would bring to the table, which would be additive to someone's grow processes. But we are, you know, we've had a couple conversations this year with one company in particular, and they have all these grand plans on, you know, we're going to be in this state and this state and this state. And we sort of said, oh, whoa, hold on. Like, I think it's really important to show that you have critical mass, that you're executing well in the states that you're in. And then I think that you should be, you know, fairly measured and incrementalist as you add on additional states, just to make sure that you have, you know, the management focus, the talent, and the capital to pull it off. So it's a terrific point. I mean, people early on in this industry, going back 5 years ago, call it, you know, you looked at a comp sheet from with all the different cannabis companies on them. And, you know, next to the name of the company, they typically have, you know, the states that you're in. And with the presumption that the number of states that you are in should somehow play into what kind of multiple you were getting. So, oh my gosh, you know, these guys are in 17 states. These guys are in 15 states. And, oh, they're going to be a winner. And how it's actually played out is a lot of those guys who were winners, you know, were sort of preordained winners 5 years ago, have been passed by because they kind of choked on the execution, the lack of execution in their business, and the amount of capital it takes to build out such a broad, far-flung operation. And there's just, it's very tough to have, you know, we're very, very blessed at Forefront that we have a lot of operating talent, as I've said over and over. And having that facility in Washington sort of breeds talent. It's almost like a training center for us. But if you don't have that, you know, trying to have a business that has standard operating procedures that people are executing across the platform, it's very, very tough to do that, you know, with a very aggressive M&A approach. So a measured approach, I think, is one that you know, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. With this like M&A frenzy, when you see some of these deals come out, do you, you know, how do you process some of them? Do you think, you know, this might be a threat, or this is actually going to be good for us, or this doesn't make any sense? You know, how do you sort of look at what your competitors do and analyze that?
We know the states we're in incredibly well. Actually, we have a very good sense of the market and where we want to be. And obviously, we love to be in limited license states. And, you know, that's sort of industry jargon. But if you look at Washington State and how that they issued those cultivation licenses and why the pricing went down so drastically in that state is because basically, you know, if you had $10,000 in a pulse, you could get a cultivation license. Mm-hmm. In a state like Massachusetts, you know, the municipalities are very, very strict on who they're letting into their towns, and the towns have a lot of power. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be, you know, Massachusetts is going to be a very limited license state for an awful long time. And obviously with limited licenses, you have, you know, more limited competition. You have pricing that's going to hold up a lot better because, you know, you just don't have the amount of capacity on the online in a state like this. So, you know, we are interested in, so having said that, given our success in Washington, we're really not scared to go into any state. You know, mm-hmm. See a big rec, if we see a big nascent rec market like California, you know, we think we're uniquely qualified to go in and take a lot of market share in a state like that, you know, given, you know, what we've proven we've been able to do in Washington. So if we look at states that we want to get into right now, I think that there are a number of them that would be really attractive to us, you know, in terms of, you know, being able to get in with fairly limited competition, some that are just on the cusp of going recreational. So, you know, then, and there are ample opportunities out there to do that.
You mentioned, you know, you've mentioned the how it looked like something from the Mars company or a consumer packaged goods company. What is your manufacturing pedigree? Do you have a lot of people that have come from food and beverage, or are they, you know, legacy cannabis operators?
So it's interesting. So Leo Gontmaker, who's our CEO, his family were emigrated from the Ukraine back in the 90s. And from a standing start, his father grew a seafood distribution business into one of the largest in the country. And so when Leo, you know, pursued that license in Washington, when Washington went rec 7 years ago, seven-ish years ago, they applied a lot of those streamlined manufacturing and packaging techniques from the seafood industry, where they're packaging and distributing, and applied them to the cannabis industry. And so, you know, really succinctly, a lot of our production capabilities came out of the seafood industry.
Okay.
And, you know, where you're packaging, you're doing white label for folks, you're distributing. We distribute to, you know, 260 dispensaries in any given month in Washington. And we're going to distribute to something like, you know, we hope to be in, you know, the 700 plus that are in California. But, you know, simply put, you know, a lot of, you know, how we got started streamlining and adding some of this automation, you know, was really adapted from the seafood industry.
You talk about having a deep bench. How many employees do you have now?
I think we're up around 800 right now.
Okay.
So, it's a sneaky big company.
Right? From a smaller consultancy to a company of nearly 1,000 employees?
Yeah, it's a lot to manage. It's a big operation, you know, and I think that the folks who are able to attract the best talent are going to have it's almost trite to say, but talent is so scarce in this industry. Mm-hmm. And being able to home grow your talent in the way that you want is really important. One of the things that we found is when you bring in executives into the cannabis industry from outside, you know, from big retail or big consumer packaged goods, they've had a tough time navigating in the cannabis industry, we found. You know, they're used to sort of bigger budgets. They aren't really used to rolling up their sleeves. They, you know, want big branding budgets. And, you know, it's just very hit or miss so far hiring from outside of the cannabis industry. So we've taken this mantra to heart of, you know, we're going to home grow our own talent. And, you know, we're fortunate to, you know, have a great presence in Washington that sort of produces that.
So how do you make sure that your homegrown talent isn't poached?
We are very heavy on, you know, we have stock options that, you know, our folks, you know, participate in. But I think the biggest thing is to have a good culture where, you know, people feel appreciated. They like coming to work. They like being on a winning team. We said, you know, there's a comment made in one of our executive meetings years ago where, you know, everyone was like, oh, it'll be great. We'll get everyone t-shirts and everyone will have a lot of team spirit and won't this be great? And Carl Toscano said, don't underestimate the amount of goodwill and the amount of positive mojo, you know, people get from being on a winning team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can see that, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, we know what we're doing as an operator and we're giving people plenty of room to, you know, not only learn, but have fun, but to grow their careers as we continue to expand. So, you know, it's sort of that mixture of, you know, making sure that, you know, they're aligned from, you know, an ownership standpoint, and then, you know, making sure that they're appreciated and have opportunities for, you know, to expand their career.
So, you've discussed a lot of these expansion plans and new facilities that are coming online. I wanted to ask you a bit about, you know, so how has COVID impacted those new plans as well as your entire operation?
Knocking on wood, we were incredibly lucky with COVID in terms of it didn't have a huge effect on our facilities. We sprung into action, you know, right when the pandemic started. You know, with pretty stringent mask restrictions and hygiene restrictions. So, you know, we were terrified as a management team, like, whoa, what if this COVID rips through our entire facility and we don't have anyone to do the work? And so we've been very fortunate on that side of things. And so our outside of COVID slowing down our expansion in Brookline, just because the planning board didn't meet for, you know, 5 or 6 months during, you know, the peak of COVID and sort of slowed us down a little bit, we really haven't had a whole lot of detrimental effects from the pandemic on our business. In fact, you know, many would argue that, you know, the pandemic has been very good for cannabis consumption. Mm-hmm. With people at home, you know, you always see, you know, during turbulent times, you always see liquor sales start to tick up. And I think cannabis rhymed with that during this pandemic. And it was kind of interesting, mm-hmm. in that, you know, in Massachusetts, you know, cannabis was an essential service. And yeah. That was, you know, it's come a long way in 5 years. I used to have to go and do a tap dance to let politicians let me into their town. And now we're being, you know, labeled as an essential service. So, you know, a few little delays on construction projects here and there from COVID, but by and large, the pandemic, you know, was actually good for business. That's okay to say, but it's sort of been yeah. The case.
Well, I've heard that. I was just curious because of your unique position where you have you're reliant on cannabis sales, but you're also bringing these new facilities online. So I didn't know if you were running any supply chain issues, equipment issues in terms of like getting those up and running.
We really haven't had major supply chain issues. We had, you know, some of our equipment manufacturers were for our equipment that just went into California. You know, it's a German-based company. So you had to get, you know, folks from Germany into the country, make sure that they had their vaccination cards, make sure they had their proper visas, you know, added, you know, layers of stickiness for things like that in terms of getting people on site. But again, kind of minor delays that you know, have been manageable.
Okay. You said you had, I think it's 20 different brands, 2,000 different product lines. Do you have a personal favorite?
I'm very partial to our Terp Sticks.
Yeah.
Our Terp Sticks are infused pre-rolls. Mm. And so it's cannabis with sort of a proprietary process where we put distillate throughout the joint. And you know, they're real fan favorites. They're my favorite. It's sort of like ordering a drink with a floater on top. And you know, provide a great kick. They've been incredibly popular in Washington, popular here in Massachusetts as well. We're rolling it out across the country. I mean, that's my favorite product. And I don't think that we can ever go wrong with the Marmas. Our gummy cube is delicious. Mm-hmm. Love the effect, love the flavor. It's pre-wrapped, so it doesn't melt together with the other ones. And the price is right. So I think I put those as my top two.
Okay. What are your expectations, you know, not just for Forefront, but for the industry, let's say over the next 5 years?
I think that we have long said as an industry, eventually big alcohol, tobacco, the big consumer products companies are going to start coming into this business. And we've sort of said, oh, well, you know, they've been looking, you know, clearly folks are paying attention. And that was sort of the mantra over the last 5 years. I can tell you for a fact that is no longer a one day they will come. Mm-hmm. Those companies are being very active right now, looking at getting into cannabis, and they want companies with a good footprint, meaning a good addressable market, preferably in some protected states in that portfolio. They also want to see that you have scale, and they want to see that you bring some, you know, they underscale, those types of companies understand large scale production, but large scale production in cannabis is sort of nuanced. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to bring some of those scaled growing and processing techniques to the table. So I think that over the next over the next 5 years, you know, this is going to be a consolidated industry. I think that the spoils are going to, by and large, go to the bigger companies, because if we can get banking through the Senate here, I think that that is going to be an absolute game changer for this industry. It not only lets the cost of capital go, well, it gives you access to banking for one, but your cost of capital comes down, and you're going to be able to uplist to, you know, NASDAQ, NYSE, real exchanges, which in turn is going to allow large institutional investors to come in the space. And they have been largely barred to this point. Mm-hmm. From my knowledge, the only big sort of plain vanilla mutual fund company who is invested in cannabis in earnest is Putnam here in Boston. Mm-hmm. But, you know, think about what that means for an industry where you have that tsunami of institutional capital that comes into this space. You're looking at multiples right now for some of the leadership in cannabis trading at 5, 6, 7 times next year's EBITDA. Mm-hmm. That's a really cheap multiple for an industry that's grown 40-50% top line, profitable, and is probably in the second or third inning of growth here. So I think that, you know, we have a lot of room for multiples to expand as this industry grows and we attract real institutional investors and not just, you know, retail traders.
Coming from the traditional finance side, what was it like? What has it been like this last, you know, nearly a decade of operating a business and with non-traditional banking options?
It's been really, really hard. You know, early on we had to, you know, finance our grow facilities with, you know, by selling equity in the company. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's unheard of. You know, mm-hmm. you have companies that are out there that just do equipment financing, but they wouldn't do it in the cannabis industry. So in the early days, you know, it was very dilutive to the ownership, you know, because you'd have to finance things with equity. And, you know, if regulators or the brokerage houses that I had my brokerage account shut down when they figured out I was an executive, I've had, you know, my B of A account shut down. It's painful, from a personal standpoint, but from a business standpoint, you've been able to navigate getting banking. You can find a bank in every state that'll kind of play ball with the cannabis industry and, you know, have pretty stringent compliance guidelines. But by and large, those banks will just give you banking services, you know, to accept, you know, take receipt of your cash and those types of things. But they wouldn't help you with business financing or mezzanine loans or anything like that. And I think that the cost of capital coming down when banking laws change, it's going to take so much friction out of, you know, getting stuff done in this industry. So we've scraped and clawed, but you know, seeing banking on the horizon is very welcome for the guy in my seat.
You had mentioned that, you know, you're currently in the market for, you know, other acquisition targets, bolt-on acquisitions. You know, do you foresee in the future where you're the acquisition target from one of those larger big tobacco, big alcohol players trying to get in the industry?
Yes. Yeah, I think that size is going to matter. Mm-hmm. And if you can find the right combination that, you know, gets you not only size, but, you know, deep pocketed partner, is going to be a big deal. And why I say that is I think, you know, liquidity in a lot of these stocks has been really, really low. Mm-hmm. And the natural buyers for these stocks has been fairly limited. When institutions come in, they aren't going to want to, you know, by and large, they aren't going to want to look at a smaller stock that trades, you know, $300,000 a day and say, yeah, that's the one I want to get into. You know, when Fidelity and BlackRock and Wellington and any of these other big mutual fund complexes come in, you know, they not only want, you know, good operations and a good company, a good collection of assets, but they're going to pay attention to liquidity. And by and large, you know, the larger companies that are easier to buy, have more critical mass, I think are going to be more attractive for that capital. And so we always have an eye towards, you know, getting bigger, and we have a pretty clear path to value creation just with what we're doing. But I would be very surprised if we were a standalone company 2 years from now.
Professionally, is cannabis it for you, or, you know, is there potentially another career in there somewhere?
I don't know. I've thought about this a lot. I'm kind of unique in that I've worked kind of in a traditional finance background, and now I've been in the cannabis and inside the industry as an operator for 7 years. And there aren't a lot of folks out there that have seen both sides of the coin like that. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of opportunities in cannabis sort of for my next act. So I think that, wherever the future leads me, I think I probably have one or two more stops in cannabis before I go on to do something else, because it's still so rich with opportunity and, you know, there's a lot of stuff to do. There are a lot of projects you could take on to create value.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for taking the time today. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, it's great to be here. Thanks so much, Dan.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for your time and insight. I really do appreciate it. It sounds like 4Front is doing a lot of very interesting and exciting things. Before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also do us a big favor by leaving us a positive review on whatever platform you use. Finally, if you want to reach the podcast, you can email me at david@cannabisequipmentnews.com with email, the podcast, and the subject line. Also, if you want to make sure you get it in your inbox first, please make sure to subscribe to our newsletter. All right. Thanks again to Andrew Toot. I'm David Manti. This is the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening to the Cannabis Equipment News Podcast.